Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Our musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. It was on this very day back in 1963 that a controversial song was released by a group called the Kingsmen. What is the name of this song that rose to number two on the U.S. charts by the Kingsmen? Hint. This song was investigated by the FBI to unscramble the hidden messages in the lyrics. Was that A, Walk Like a Man, B, Louie Louie, C, Hello Mother, Hello Father, or D, Da Do Ron Ron? 1963? FBI investigation. Obscene lyrics? And question number two, was on this day back in 1969 that the song Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which had been released 20 years earlier, finally received a gold record. Who was the singer of this song? Hint, here's a snippet from one of this singer's other's recordings.
I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly jimson wheat. Back in the saddle again.
Familiar voice? Who is this singer who sang Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer that finally received a gold record back in 1969, 20 years after it was released? Is that voice A, Roy Rogers, B, Johnny Cash, C, Willie Nelson, or D, Gene Autry? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program.
Back in the saddle again.
Our transitions come to us from that very same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of November the 9th. Well, it was on this day back in 1938 that Kate Smith first sang Irving Berlin's God Bless America on network radio. 1938. And it was 60 years ago today, 1958, that Hank Ballard and the Midnighters recorded The Twist. This version was a moderate hit in 1960. Chubby Checker's cover version later on gave rise to the Twist dance craze. 1958 for this Hank Ballard tune.
When you look back on times we had, I hope you smile and know that through the good and through the bad, I was on your side when nobody could hold us down.
Carrie Underwood's Whenever You Remember introduces our country music news. Main Street Outlaws' new country albums subtly mess with musical and political rules. This is a review of three brand new albums. Carrie Underwood's Cry Pretty, which is given 3.5 out of 5 stars. Rustin Kelly's Dying Stars, which is given 4 full stars out of 5. And various artists, King of the Road, is given 3 out of 5 stars. Review is written by Will Hermes, published in Rolling Stone, September 2018. Carrie Underwood is Arena Country's mightiest voice, as Cry Pretty reaffirms. The architecture is often R&B at its core. Listen to the slow jam showpiece, Drinking Alone. Most striking, though, are The Bullet and Love Wins, both addressing gun violence. She doesn't advocate reforming our laws, but at least Underwood has the guts to engage the subject in the Nashville mainstream. A Southern singer-songwriter who owes a debt to outlaw icon Kris Kristofferson, Rustin Kelly deserves to be known as more than Kacey Musgraves' husband. Dying Star should fix that. He projects a beautiful loser vibe, as song titles like Faceplant and Blackout suggest, while he's writing his dumbhead tight. So are the songs of Roger Miller, a legend for whom genre wasn't no thing. King of the Road pays tribute with a weird casting call, Toad the Wet Sprocket. But Musgrave owns Kansas City Star, and Eric Church turns the gibberish jam Ooh Dee Lolly into a swampy ramble. And once again, that was Carrie Underwood singing in the background. Joseph Haydn's String Quartet in C introduces our classical music news. It's an article entitled Surprise Symphony, Work by Haydn. Betsy Schwarm's the writer, Encyclopedia Britannica's the source. Surprise Symphony, Symphony No. 94 in G major, an orchestral work by Austrian composer Joseph Haydn, so named for the quote-unquote surprise, a startling loud chord that interrupts the otherwise soft and gentle flow of the second movement. The distinctive feature did not appear in the original score. Rather, it was added by the composer on a whim for the piece's London premiere in 1792 and was retained for later performances. For most of his career, which spanned primarily the second half of the 18th century, Haydn served as music director for the court of the Hungarian Esterházy family. In 1790, Haydn was finally free to travel, and he set out for England, spurred by an invitation from Johann Peter Salomon, a German-born violinist and impresario who presented 6 months of concerts in London each year. Londoners turned out by the thousands to watch him conduct premieres of his new works, and critics and audiences alike were generous with their praise. Among the works heard at these concerts were 12 new symphonies, the last ones Haydn ever wrote, including the perennial popular Symphony No. 94 in G major. The piece gained fame when the composer himself, while conducting himself, impulsively altered the dynamics of the second movement. According to one account, Haydn had already given the downbeat to begin the movement when the gentle snores of a front-row patron piqued his sense of humor. He and his musicians forged ahead with the little theme until reaching its final chord, for which Haydn cued an immense fortissimo loud tone, bringing the drowsy patron to his feet. Whatever is Haydn's motivation, the episode ultimately earned for the work its everlasting nickname, Surprise Symphony. Beyond such colorful anecdotes, the four-movement symphony follows a structure that was, at the time, still considered novel. It begins with a generally lively movement that offers several contrasting melodies. The second movement proceeds at a gentler pace, though with the moment of surprise, and the third movement is dance-flavored, specifically resembling the then-popular minuet, a predecessor of the waltz. The last movement is the liveliest of all, with brisk and scurrying ideas that bring the piece to an energetic conclusion. Such a pattern became the norm for symphonies in the decades that followed, largely due to the initiative and stature of Haydn himself. He pioneered the structure, and his popularity was such that other composers, including Mozart and Beethoven, chose his work as their model for how a symphony should be composed. In jazz and blues music news, we have Dave Brubeck's Take Five. Introducing this article, Second Russian Jazz Conference, slated for mid-November. This is published in Jazz Times on the 1st of November 2018. The second iteration of Jazz Across Borders will be held on November the 16th and 17th in St. Petersburg, Russia, as part of the St. Petersburg International Cultural Forum. The two-day event, meant for members of the jazz industry to meet and network with one another, will feature a slate of master classes, performances, and discussions touching on such topics as promotion and music education. It will be attended by producers, club and festival directors, promoters, and record company representatives. This year's special guest will include Jason Olane, Director of Programming and Touring at Jazz at Lincoln Center, Fernando Souza, Program Director at the Casa de Música Foundation in Portugal, and Jill Roger, Program Director of the Glasgow Phil Jazz Festival. Jazz Across Borders had its debut last year with more than 1,000 attendees from 32 countries. Last year, we had an incredible event, Igor Butman, the president of Jazz Across Borders, said in a press release. Major promoters, prominent figures of the jazz industry, young musicians, representatives of big and small festivals, our teachers and students, all of us came together for the common goal, to show and prove to others that jazz art is being developed, loved and appreciated in this country, and that we want to continue developing and improving this genre of music. Lennon's Imagine introduces our music research and technology article entitled A Songwriting Mystery Solved. Math Proves John Lennon Wrote In My Life. This is written by Scott Simon and Ned Wharton on the 11th of August 2018 and published in NPR.org. Lennon McCartney is likely one of the most famous songwriting credits in music. John Lennon and Paul McCartney wrote lyrics and music for almost 200 songs, and the Beatles have sold hundreds of millions of albums. The story goes that the two Beatles agreed as teenagers to the joint credit for all songs they wrote, no matter the divide in work. Over the years, Lennon and McCartney have revealed who really wrote what, but some songs are still up for debate. The two even debate between themselves. Their memories seem to differ when it comes to who wrote the music for 1965's In My Life. If the songwriters' memories, perhaps tainted by the mind-altering era they were writing in, have failed, how can this mystery ever be solved? Well, we can get by with a little help from math. Mathematics professor Jason Brown spent 10 years working with Stanford University mathematician Keith Devlin. and they break down how Brown figured it out. Here's Devlin's edited conversation with NPR's Scott Simon. So Jason Brown used statistics to solve the magical mystery. Scott Simon says, I don't understand bags of words representations, although I've sometimes been called a bag of words by some. Keith Devlin replies, we'll get to that. First of all, just to say that this is really serious stuff in terms of what was done. The three co-authors of this paper, Mark Glickman, who was a statistician at Harvard, he's also a classical pianist, another Harvard professor of engineering called Ryan Song, and the third person was a university mathematician called Jason Brown. He figured out how the Beatles created that striking opening chord in Hard Day's Night. And at that time, I actually said he was working on who wrote the music for In My Life. And 10 years later, here we are talking about that discovery. It took him a long time, but he's now got it. Bags of words? What are they? It actually goes back to the 1950s. It's used by the computer scientist who created spam filters. What you do is you take a piece of text and you ignore the grammar, you ignore the word order, and you just regard it as a collection of words. And once you've done that, you can count the frequencies of the different words in the bag of words. You do it for music. You had to get little snippets, and the way they did that was the team analyzed, I think, about 70 songs from Lennon and McCartney, and they found there were 149 very distinct transitions between notes and chords that are present in almost all Beatles songs, and those transitions will be unique to one person or the other. Now, part of the confusion is that Paul McCartney said he wrote the music. John Lennon said Paul McCartney wrote a section of music. So what did this trio of mathematicians detect? Well, cutting to the chase, it turns out Lennon wrote the whole thing. When you do the math by counting the little bits that are unique to the people, the probability that McCartney wrote it was 0.018. That's essentially zero. In other words, this is pretty well definitive. Lennon wrote the music. And in situations like this, you'd better believe the math, because it's much more reliable than people's recollections, especially given they collaborated writing it in the 60s with an incredibly altered mental state due to all the stuff they were ingesting. I know what you're saying. I would go with mathematics. Keith says, all right. I ask you, what about the artistic process of collaboration? Isn't it possible they were such close and accomplished collaborators that they inhaled a little bit of each other's technique, and Lennon could write like McCartney and McCartney like John Lennon? For sure. And that's why it's hard for the human ear to tell the thing apart. It's also hard for them to realize who did it. And this is why, actually, the only reliable answer is the mathematics. Because no matter how much people collaborate, they're still the same people, and they have their preferences without even realizing it. Lennon would use certain kinds of things over and over again. So would McCartney. It was the collaboration. Those two things come together that works, but they were still separate little bits. The mathematics isolates those little bits that are unique to the two people.
Of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. You.
Tom Petty's I Won't Back Down introduces our rock and pop music news. This is written by David Fricke and published in Rolling Stone magazine, October 2018 issue, entitled Petty's Unearthed Treasures, diving into an incredible box of unreleased music. Arriving just a year after Tom Petty's death, the four-disc An American Treasure is the kind of memorial box set that usually appears later in an artist's wake. opening with one of the first and best of those orphans, Surrender, from his 1976 first album Sessions with the Heartbreakers. Here is Petty's life in relentlessly high standards, the jangling optimism of Keep a Little Soul, 1982, the bar band boot camp memoir Gainesville, left off 1999's Echo. A campfire folk take on that album's Don't Fade on Me has a Petty vocal that could have come from the freewheeling Bob Dylan. Even the hits in these 60 tracks go through changes, often in performance, a soul jam breakdown from a 1977 radio concert, a stark acoustic I Won't Back Down from 20 years later, and the oldest song here, Lost in Your Eyes, a deep soul ballad from Petty's struggling 70s. Still sounds like a classic in waiting. I've got so much music left in me that I want to get out, Petty told me in 2014, still a youthful 63. When asked about the pressures of mortality, I don't know if I'll have the time. He worked with that same urgency all down the line. John Cougar Mellencamp's Wild Nights introduces our local music news, an article titled Prince Charming. Will Oldham, songwriter, actor, storyteller, poet, unfolds his Bonnie Prince Billy catalog at Duke. This is written by Jim Allen, published in The Independent on the 19th of September, 2018. The only reality that matters is the one that's being built as you listen second by second to this song, says singer-songwriter Will Oldham, describing the creative space he shares with his audience. Under the banners of Bonnie Prince Billy, Palace Brothers, and other permutations of the Palace moniker, Oldham has blurred the lines between folk, country, and underground experimentalism since the early 90s, earning a reputation as a true American original. While Oldham has never been a road dog, keeping his performance schedule to a minimum over the years, he's been a prolific recording artist, cutting some 25 albums since 1993, and an even greater number of EPs and one-off singles. Recently, Oldham gave admirers a peek behind the curtain in a Duke University residency, featuring a unique concert and a pair of lectures touching on his technique for writing, performing, and recording. Oldham's earliest songwriter impetus came as a Louisville, Kentucky kid, attending summer camp in southern Indiana, the only Kentuckian in the bunch of Midwesterners. Around the campfire, he found that his fellow campers were more interested in acts like Neil Young and the Grateful Dead, and especially in fellow Hoosier John Cougar Mellencamp. Oldham says, when I see what a song does to other people, I think, oh, that's really what you want to do, is make a song that people have a shared experience with. It should be about something as collective as possible. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our second question, it was on this day back in 1969 that the song Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which had been released 20 years earlier, finally received a gold record. Who was the singer of this song? And I played a snippet of that singer performing another song as a hint. The correct answer is answer D, Gene Autry. As noted in songfacts.com, the story of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was written in 1939 by Robert L. May, a copywriter for the Chicago-based Montgomery Ward Department Stores, as a promotional gift for the store's customers. The stores had bought and distributed coloring books every Christmas and saw writing their own story as a way to save money. Montgomery Ward distributed 2.4 million copies of the Rudolph booklet in 1939. A total of 6 million copies had been given out by the end of 1946, even though wartime paper shortages restricted printing. The musical version was first recorded by Gene Autry in 1949, selling 2 million copies that year. Autry didn't want anything to do with this song. It was his wife who talked him into recording it, and it went on to become the second biggest-selling Christmas song of all time, next to Bing Crosby's White Christmas. Autry was known as the singing cowboy. He teamed up with Roy Rogers in the 30s and 40s to make movies in a new genre called musical westerns. Autry had his own TV show in the 50s and was the owner of the California Angels baseball team. And the answer to our first question, it was on this very day back in 1963 that a controversial song was released by a group called the Kingsmen. What was the name of that song that rose to number 2 on the U.S. charts and was investigated by the FBI to unscramble the hidden messages in the lyrics? Correct answer was answer B, Louie Louie. As noted in songfacts.com, this was written by an R&B singer named Richard Berry. He was also the first to record it, and it got some airplay in some cities in the western U.S. when it was released in 1957. Various garage bands heard it, started covering the song until it became a phenomenon with the Kingsmen version. While much of the song's notoriety and sales comes from the indecipherable lyrics, in Berry's original version, words are quite clear. The song is about a sailor who spends 3 days traveling to Jamaica to see his girl. The FBI launched an extensive investigation into this song after Indiana Governor Matthew Welsh declared it pornographic in early 1964 and asked the Indiana Broadcasters Association to ban it. The investigation spanned offices in several states with technicians listening to the song at different speeds, trying to discern any obscene lyrics. None were ever found. So let's close out today's program with this hidden message song, Louie Louie. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program, intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website. TriangleReadingService.org. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me. Randy Thompson, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.